Some of you may have read the novel Wonder Boys by Michael Chabon, or you might have seen the film version of it with Michael Douglas and Tobey Maguire. It tells the story of a middle-aged writer and college professor named Grady Tripp. And many years ago, Grady's first novel was a hit, a bestseller, won all the prizes out there to be won, and it really touched people. It really changed their lives. But quite a bit of time has gone by since then, and he hasn't published another book, which isn't to say that he hasn't been working on one. He has, for decades, been working on exactly one book, and he just keeps writing and writing and writing, and this manuscript keeps getting longer and longer and longer, so now it fills boxes all over his office, it fills all the drawers of his desk, it fills an entire cabinet, just page after page after page. And he's filled these thousands of pages with very detailed descriptions of his characters' lives. So there are long genealogies, not just of the characters, but of their pets. There are listings of people's dental records. Just everything is in here, all kinds of minutiae. One day, one of Grady's students, Hannah, decides to try to actually read this book, everything he's written so far. So Grady can't help himself. He asks her, okay, well, what did you think? And Hannah looks around at all these boxes and drawers, all full of manuscript pages. Unnecessarily, she starts with a disclaimer. She says, well, I didn't quite finish it. And then she cautiously tries to tell Grady what she sees and what he has refused to see all this time, which is that he's lost the heart of the story. He's crowded out what's best in his book with all these layers and layers of less important details. When people ask Grady what his novel is about, he doesn't even know anymore. And Hannah says, Professor, some of this is really beautiful, but you know how you say in our creative writing workshop that writers make choices? She says, well, and again, she looks around at this endless book scattered all over the room. She says, at times, reading your book, it feels like you didn't really make any choices at all. When the Vatican pushed back at Corpus Christi for welcoming the participation of women and LGBT people and non-Catholics, when they told us to stop, as we know, Father Jim's famous response was, we had to make a choice. Do we follow the rules of our religion, or do we follow the ideals of our religion? Do we do what's lawful, or do we do what's loving? So in this gospel, the Pharisees were trying to follow all the many rules of their religion, pages and pages of detailed instructions, governing things like hand washing and how to clean pots and kettles and certain foods. It's not that such things didn't matter at all. We always have to remember when we see a passage like this that Jesus was a devout Jew and wouldn't have said these things don't matter. And yet trying to observe all of them without making choices, without prioritizing, can crowd out the heart of the faith, the heart of the story. I think about how our understanding of how to respond well to the coronavirus has changed over time. It's evolved. At first, we didn't know to wear masks, or we thought, well, maybe it can be optional, but it doesn't make such a difference in the transmission of the virus. If you remember, at first we focused a lot on cleaning processes for certain surfaces. We cleaned our groceries when we brought them home. We cleaned our mail when it arrived. We cleaned seats and tables, things like that. And later it turned out, not that these things weren't important at all, but they weren't what made the greatest impact in whether people got sick or not. Without the bigger things like mask wearing and social distancing, these other small actions weren't going to help much just by themselves. And the interesting thing was, even after this realization, some places continued using sanitizing practices that the CDC told us really weren't having much of an effect one way or the other. They kept doing them because it gave things the appearance of being clean and safe, even though they really weren't. This came to be called hygiene theater, right? And health experts had to keep reminding us again and again to follow the guidance around masks and distancing, because those were the things that were going to be most important. Here, Jesus is worried the Pharisees are becoming so concerned with surfaces and with looking like they're pure that they're losing the really important guidance of their faith, things like love of neighbor and care of the poor. One of the things that quickly became clear with COVID-19 was that we couldn't treat this only as a medical crisis. The way it struck people and communities unevenly, right, shone a light on some fault lines in our country that had been there a long, long time. COVID exposed stubborn moral sicknesses too, institutional racism, poverty wages, inequality, individualism, resistance to the common good, prejudice, violence, privilege. And it quickly became clear that if we tried to tackle the pandemic without dealing with those underlying diseases, as Jesus says, those evils that come from within, we'd still just be staying on the surface. Jesus calls here on the tradition of the prophets, who always sounded a moral wake-up call. And we know that their spirit is alive and well today. It lived in Dr. King and John Lewis and all the people who marched on Washington 58 years ago. It lives in those who marched in Washington yesterday for voting rights. So prophetic religion, thankfully, is alive and well. But it goes way back. It goes back to the beginning, to Isaiah, whom Jesus quotes, to the letter of James, that was our second reading. The writer of that letter said way back around the 3rd century or so, true religion is to care for the orphans and the widows in their affliction. So this also is an ancient tradition. The folk singer Pete Seeger was often labeled as a radical for his activism for peace, for the earth, for labor rights. He was accused of being anti-American, or frequently he was just called just way too liberal. And he had a great reply when people said this. He said, "That's wrong. Actually, I'm a conservative. I'm more conservative than Barry Goldwater." It's just that he only wanted to turn the clock back to when there was no income tax. I want to turn the clock back to when people lived in small villages and took care of each other. When the Pharisees accused Jesus of neglecting the tradition of the elders, the ritual purity laws, Jesus quotes tradition right back, the prophet's reminder that the heart of faith is justice, mercy, compassion. If we aren't living those ideals, nothing else really matters. For us, prophetic ancestors might include people like St. Francis and St. Clair, Hildegard of Bingen, Meister Eckhart, Teilhard de Chardin, Thea Bowman, Catherine of Siena, who famously wrote a letter to the Pope telling him she felt that he could do a better job at living up to his own ideals. People who loved their religion, of course, but who kept speaking up, calling for it to be better, more loving, more spiritual, more optimistic, more justice-seeking, more inclusive. People who believed, as the letter of James says, that we must be doers of the word, not hearers only. I love that line. We must be doers of the word, not hearers only. Before he became president, during his time as a state politician, FDR spent several years traveling around seeking treatment for his polio. And during that time, his wife Eleanor stepped in to carry out a lot of his political work. She got used to traveling and advocating, meeting a diversity of people, taking speaking engagements. Then, as FDR's health improved and he assumed his role again as president, he asked Eleanor to step back, to resign her position on the 17 boards that she was on, stop her community work, to go back to the traditional role of a first lady at the time. Well, Eleanor was outraged by this. She said she was afraid that now her entire life was going to be about what she called white glove tasks. One of the traditional duties of the first lady at that time was running the finger of one lace-gloved hand along the banisters of the White House, and the plates and the vases to make sure that no dust had accumulated, and that everything looked shiny and clean. So how could she go back to a life like this, when outside so many people were suffering? So she made a bold choice. She ignored the tradition of the time. She ignored the social rules that tried to hem her in as a woman, and she went out into the city and the country again. She visited homeless camps around D.C. during the Depression. She met and ate with the people there. She asked them about their lives, and then she became a tireless advocate of the poor. She visited the internment camps where Japanese Americans were held during World War II, and she fought to end them. She tried to prick the conscience of the country, and she accused the U.S. of not living up to its own ideals with the very fact that these existed. She spoke up for gender discrimination. She even wrote a public editorial criticizing FDR. And she turned him around. She changed his mind on some issues. And she spoke up against racism, even when her husband's administration turned a blind eye, as they did several times. She spoke up, and she kept insisting that none of America's other problems would be solved until we took a hard look at that, until we faced the sin of our own racism. She was a doer. She lived what she believed, and she prioritized the deepest moral issues of the time. She was a doer of the word, not just a hearer of it. There's a woman in the parish who was given a gift card by a neighbor with some money on it for groceries, I think about $85. She herself lives in a one-bedroom apartment. She lives very simply. She doesn't have a lot of wiggle room economically at all. And she's been through many struggles. Life at times has been very hard. We got a call from her at the church a little while ago saying that rather than stock her own fridge, she had used that gift card to buy food for the food cupboard outside our church out in the garden, which was already an amazing thing in and of itself. What a loving thing to do. So on the staff, we made plans to swing by in a couple days to pick up the bags of food because she doesn't drive. But that wasn't the end. A couple of days later, we got a call from her, and she was very nice, very polite about it, but she asked if maybe someone from the church could come by sooner rather than later, and she wondered if maybe we could come today. And the reason for the hurry, she added quietly, was that the bags of food that she'd bought, there were so many that they were actually crowding her out of her own apartment. She could hardly move around. She turned out she had used all the money on the gift card, the whole thing. Every bit of it went to buying food for others. This abundance of food for the food cupboard, and such an abundance, in fact, that in that very small apartment, it left no room for her. So she sacrificed not once, but twice. She gave the card, and she gave up her own living space, all to make this gift. She's a doer of the word, not just a hearer of it. Jesus is smiling. The question, do I do what's lawful or do I do what's loving, crosses our path in different disguises several times a day. In any life, there are going to be 1,000 details that threaten to obscure what matters most. It's easy to get caught up in the minutiae, amen. There will always be white glove tasks, and if we let them, they will tend to consume all of our time. And there's always the temptation to concern ourselves with surfaces and neglect the important things. Day by day, we get to decide, what will the story of our life be about? Will we let other things crowd out the call to love, the heart of the gospel? Or will we live so that love crowds out everything else? It's up to us. The choice is ours.